Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. It's now hour number two with my special guest, Stephen Berry. He's not related to Chuck Berry, although he does strum a good tune under an old willow tree. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Maybe that was a bad joke. Now, we were talking outside about Agenda 21, and you don't know a whole lot about it. In fact, I have a book over here called Behind the Green Mask. This is written by a woman named Rosa Corey, and basically what we've found is there's this green agenda, okay, you know, basically, you know how Greenpeace started up, it was about environmental issues and so on and so forth, and
yep.
They split out, and one of the main founders started up Sea Shepherd, and the reason why he split apart from Greenpeace, which he actually began, was because they were being taken over by communists.
Yep.
Now, do you see a similar agenda being at play here, how Auckland's talking about sustainability and this draft unitary plan and all of that kind of stuff? I see it just basically as sort of like an everything-ism, socialism type of experiment.
That's absolutely what it is. And when we look at the policies of the Green Party, their environmental aims, you know, that's great. We should be looking after the environment. But every single proposal the Green Party puts forward to protect the environment is about control. We want to tax you, we want to regulate you, we want to ban things. It's all about control.
So that's basically what the draft unitary plan would wind up accomplishing, don't you think?
Absolutely. You know, I support private property rights. I want people to be able to do what they want on their property as long as it doesn't violate other people's property rights. So you're not going to see a system where you have a 20-storey apartment right next to a one-storey residential home, because that's obviously going to violate your neighbour's property rights. But as much as possible, people should just be doing what they want with their own land. Mm. And the unitary plan very specifically sets out exactly what you can do on your own land, to the point where it's not really even worth owning property. I mean, I rent currently, so my landlord tells me what I can do with the house, and that's fine. But if I went and bought a house, I'd just have the council telling me what I can do with it.
Well, can you explain exactly how the unitary plan is supposed to be working?
Well, it's good. It will set areas like the
central. I understand that that's a broad question.
It is, yeah.
So maybe we can start off on explaining some elements of it. I mean, first of all, define what is a unitary plan.
A unitary plan sets out specific zones throughout the city where you can do certain functions with your property. So inside the inner city, you're allowed to build high apartments, and it's actually forced intensification. In the outer suburbs, it's forced sprawl. So there will be areas where you can only have one or two stories. There will be other areas where you can build up to three stories. And I don't think we need that sort of plan. I think we need people making their own decisions about their property. When you have a plan like this, the compliance with the plan drives up property prices, because there's so many regulatory hoops to jump through. It drives up the cost of construction incredibly. And
which filters down to the renters.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, the people who are renting are often lower-income people, so it's just actually making the poor poorer. Mm. And another example would be the urban boundary, which dictates you can only build residential housing within this boundary. What do you think happens to the prices when you artificially cut off supply? They go up. I mean, that's basic fifth-form economics. We saw those graphs when we went to high school, so why the hell isn't the council getting this?
Well, maybe they're doing it intentionally. the question is, who benefits?
Well, property developers, I suppose. No, I'll take that back, actually, because I think property developers would benefit more if they were able to build wider and build freer.
Now, here's one part of the Agenda 21 clause is the propensity for the domination of public-private partnerships. This is how they plan to bring the entire world under corporate control, is through step-by-step public-private partnerships. And also public-private partnership recipients, like companies and so on and so forth, will be immune from prosecution for any dodgy buildings and things of that nature. For example, if you were part of a government-mandated company and you built a whole bunch of leaky homes, and people tried to come after you for building all those leaky homes and ruining their lives and their finances and all of that kind of stuff, you wouldn't be able to do anything because they're a recipient.
Yep.
Right? Practical immunity. So again, it creates this disparity, and as I was speaking about before, it's going to have the super poor and the super rich, and only them, and it'll eventually wipe out the middle class, which, in my opinion, if you don't have a middle class, you don't have freedoms.
Mm. And we also have to remember, with our own leaky home crisis in Auckland, all those homes were signed off by the council as being safe. The council must take a lot of responsibility for that. Unfortunately, I don't know how we can afford to bail out the people who have been wronged by the council. It's a very difficult issue.
In Canada, they had a similar crisis, I believe, and what the local government did was it instantly paid off. Just this is how much we need our house to be repaired, so they instantly paid them off and allowed those people to repay back the council if they wound up getting any resolution with the companies, which they did. So at least this way they have their home, not a leaky building, and it's all fixed and everything like that, and then they can worry about the other things, rather than what's happening in New Zealand at the moment, where you've got a leaky home, you either have enough money to fix it or you don't, and you're screwed and you'll never get any compensation.
Yeah, that sounds pretty fair. I mean, seeing as the council signed these things off, they must take responsibility for it.
But again, who are they taking all that money off in order to compensate for their own incompetence? Yeah, they're taking it off everybody else.
That's right.
And it comes back to passing the buck and this bailout kind of mentality that we've got here. This is just terrible.
Yep, and what really should be happening is that the companies that have screwed up these houses should be paying the cost for it, but of course the council does wear a lot of responsibility for signing them off.
Well, how exactly do you make accountable government in that, say, like, for example, Penny Broad is a mayoral candidate, you know, you ran against her in the election, and she wanted to create a division of council specifically to protect whistleblowers from council-controlled organisations, private contractors, and what have you. So if anything corrupt or any misappropriation of funds, bribery, lack of accountability and what have you was going on, that the council would actually provide a framework by which those people could come forth and indeed wind up bringing these people to justice.
I would have to look at the details of that closer to make a proper comment on it. My initial instinct is always to oppose yet another council body. I think we have quite enough of them, and we also have a court system which works perfectly well, but I'd be willing to have a look at it.
I'd completely disagree about the court system working perfectly well. We've got quite a lot of disparities in there, and of course, I was just thinking about Len Brown in terms of if he cheats on his wife, for how long was it that he was...
2 years, so he can hardly claim it was one mistake. It was several mistakes.
Me love you a long time. And what if you're supposed to be the pinnacle of trustworthiness, a community man, and what have you, and then you pull something like this, you get the natural reaction from the public, which is what the protest is about. Step down, Len Brown.
Yep. I do want to make clear, the affair itself
is inconsequential.
Him cheating on his wife, none of my business. I don't care what he does in his private life. However, when you shag on the desk at work, when you jerk off in your office, when you have sex in the Ngāti Whātua room, that crosses the line. If I had sex at work on my desk, got caught, job gone.
Yeah.
Instant.
Especially in the deli section.
Oh, no, he's got some meat on him.
No one would buy the sausages again, sir.
Apart from the woman that you're doing
it. I mean, that is definitely unprofessional, and you should get fired for that.
In fact, anybody, anywhere, in any form of employment, having sex at work, or on your boss's property, or somebody else's property, or even taxpayer-funded property, and what have you, so that you can have a nice... I think I'll stop it right there. yeah, again, fired. Yep. Boom! Anybody can do that. But he's number one, isn't he?
Yep, and there
who
is...
Who can fire the mayor?
There is no process to get rid of him. I think what they have in California, Wisconsin, probably a lot more US states, where there's the capacity for voters to hold referendums to recall their elected officials. I think that's a model that we should be using here.
Mm. Well, including binding referendums as well, because I'm quite sick constantly by the fact that we have people like the Labours and Greens and so on and so forth that go around and they do these massive collections of signatures and the public's like on board, no, we don't want the privatisation. You know, ideology aside, what the people want is what the people should probably get. You know, the will of the people is the basis of the authority of government, allegedly. And yet, it doesn't matter. At any point that there's ever been a referendum in this country, it has made zero difference to public policy.
Mm. I'm not actually a supporter of binding referendums. Mm. The national government did campaign on the partial privatisation of assets. They were elected with a resounding number of votes, of 49% of the vote. I think they had a mandate to do that. The other issue I have with binding referendums is that things like individual rights, individual liberty, property rights, I don't think that should be up for a public vote. I don't think that your rights are dictated by the majority, and I don't think that 50.1% of the people should be able to tell 49.9% of the people what they can and can't do with their lives. So I do think binding referendum can actually be quite dangerous to individual liberty.
Mm-hmm.
But so in the case of recall elections, well, that's what democracy is all about, so I think that's fine.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also there's the other thing. I mean, if you have a look at, say, some of the promises of John Key, and... can you name me one thing he's promised before an election that he went through with after the election and precisely the way he said he would do it?
He did go through with the the partial privatisations. He did promise that. I mean, there's other cases, obviously, the GST. I think he was probably not completely upfront about that. And, I mean, while I am a National Party member, it's a broad church. I don't support everything they do. Overall, though, I do think he has been quite an effective Prime Minister. But there are the things I mentioned earlier where all these things Labour did which they opposed while they're in opposition, they haven't rolled back in government, so that's definitely something for them to improve on.
Mm-hmm. And I don't think Labour's really any better. I mean, it was actually quite interesting. I found when David Shearer got taken over by David Cunliffe, then I compared Cunliffe and John Key. John Key's the MP of Helensville, which is in West Auckland, and he lives in Parnell, which is a swanky inner suburb. And then David Cunliffe is an MP in New Lynn, which is out west, but he lives in Herne Bay, which is a swanky inner suburb. John Key was educated overseas and spent most of his working life overseas working for international banks and what have you. And David Cunliffe was educated overseas and spent most of the time working for international organisations.
Yep.
I don't really see a difference.
Yeah.
All I see is globalism.
Mm.
I don't see any New Zealanders who are educated, born and raised and have the community's best interests at heart getting anywhere near the policy level.
Mm. Yep, definitely difficult, especially if you don't have the money. I mean, Brown spent, over $300,000 on his campaign. I spent $4,000, and that was all my own money.
Where did Brown get his cash from? From a trust?
Yes.
From a secret trust? Could it not be more obvious? I mean, Transparency International calls New Zealand one of the first I think, top three least corrupt countries in the world.
I'd hate to visit those other corrupt countries.
Well, what I found interesting is that one of these other top two least corrupt countries in the world was, I think, Finland, whose immigration policy allows for 500 people to immigrate every year. New Zealand, and that's at a population of, I think, between 10 and 14 million, I forget which. New Zealand allows 50,000 immigrants per year plus, and we only have a population of 4 million.
Mm.
So you have a rapid saturation of different cultures within our country, and I think that what that does is it actually breaks up communities community and destroys the local culture, because there's just not quite so much of it going around. It becomes multicultural.
Mm.
And when something's multicultural, trying to campaign on a platform to bring all those different cultures together becomes impossible. And so most people just don't vote, and whatever happens, happens.
Mm.
Right? There's no community participation. There's very little assimilation for the immigrant cultures that we have in this. We've got several suburbs in this city that are very, very ethnic in terms of, you know, a certain group of people from a certain nationality will live in, say, Howick, for example, has a large quantity of Chinese immigrants.
Yep.
And that's actually produced new immigrants parties and so on and so forth. We're actually changing the political and social dynamic at the same time that we're allowing new people to come into the country, and at the same time that we're, you know, first equal least corrupt country in the world, the other ones are like Singapore, which is run by one guy and his family, who are the heads of all the government departments. and when we get sent the Transparency International sends you a checklist, all right, like a forms to fill out, you know, has there been any corruption in your country? New Zealand goes, no, we're not filling anything out. Sends it back. It's like, bang, we're the least corrupt. And, you know, it sounds funny and it sounds crazy, but that's actually how it works. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
You know, you have a look at all these international regulations and things, and it's just so one-eyed, one-sided. Everything in this country seems to be corrupt from the ground up.
It was interesting that the UN sent back 155 recommendations to our government on how to improve our human rights record. I don't know what those recommendations are. I would suspect a lot of them aren't actually human rights. They're more you have a right to something, yeah, which I don't particularly agree with, but it'd be interesting to see what's on that list.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have a right to not be killed by police officers for no good reason, I think, you know.
Yeah, yeah. That's a human right.
Considering there's been nearly 1,400 people killed by New Zealand police officers in the line of duty since the late 60s, and not one of those cops has ever gone to jail as a result, I think there's something we could do about that, you know. The police have been getting a bad rap recently, you know, like there were these rapists on YouTube and what have you, and they were reported to the police, and the police did nothing about them.
Yeah.
And then I think Martin Bradbury, I mean, make what you want of him, comes out and criticises them, and then he's going to be taken to court to either receive an exorbitant fine or a jail term for criticising the New Zealand police of a lack of action.
Oh, I saw he did that cartoon about better work stories, didn't he?
And what happens is, it occurs to me that that's really kind of not a good idea. I mean, we want to increase respect for the police by fining people and jailing them who criticise us.
Yeah, that's probably the wrong way to go.
How about this? Stop killing people! Stop killing people and ruthlessly beating people to death, you know? Maybe that would increase the amount of respect that you got. Perhaps, I don't know, you know, yeah. I'm not a sociologist, but I think that beating the shit out of people so that they die in the line of duty and then never getting fired, or maybe even if you do get fired, not going to jail for murder or grievous bodily harm or something like that, the same laws that the rest of us are supposed to be held towards, I think that decreases respect in the police, because it occurs to me that it means that the police don't have any respect for us.
Yeah. And let's not get it wrong. I mean, the majority of police do a fantastic job, and I think overall we do have a very professional police force, but there's always room for improvement.
Oh, yeah, and they're hard to bribe in this country too.
Yeah. I mean, that's good or bad, depending on which side you're on.
That's actually one of the good stats about this country is, what was it? I think Bali, for example, if you get caught with some weed or some drugs there, you can actually just give a relatively small amount of money to the cop to look the other way.
Mm.
In New Zealand, it's actually, I think it's allegedly one of the hardest places in the world to bribe frontline police staff.
Well, they pay pretty well too, so.
Allegedly. Mm. And in fact, I spoke to a, he might have been a detective, I think. And he was concerned that, I think this was back when I was a cannabis campaigner, and what he was saying to me was that we had these big signs that said, end the drug war, and he recommended that we change the sign to say, end the drug war, wipe out the gangs, and I was talking to him about this, and he says that when, even though he's a detective and he's getting paid more than regular police, he has to pay for his fuel and all of these other things, and he's got to pay his rent and his food, and it's actually quite difficult to survive even for, on a detective's wage.
No.
Now, I think professional policing is supposed to be about integrity and community spirit, mostly. When you're defending people from attackers and what have you, I think that's the highest calling for a police, and they put themselves in harm's way a lot of the time. However, all too often we hear these horror stories where it is not the offender that has caused the violence, it is in fact the police who started it all along. And indeed, whenever you take these people to court, the police close ranks, much like a gang, and in fact refer to themselves as the largest gang in New Zealand, deny, 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 unless there's video or audio evidence of them lying, and they get off. Now, that's really concerning to me, because, again, we're talking about this giant spectra of a lack of accountability, both within central government, local government, and indeed government departments in the whole. I mean, who do you complain to if the police do something bad to you? You complain to the police, Independent Police Conduct Authority, which is staffed exclusively by police, who are the biggest gang in the country, according to themselves.
Yeah, and I can see some merit in not having the police involved in that process.
I mean, a truly independent police commission against corruption of some description would actually be a much better thing than whatever we've got now. Perhaps it shouldn't even be staffed by police at all. You don't have that loyalty value. You need independence in order to actually critically analyse things that are truly happening, and in order to solve those problems without unflinching loyalty.
Yeah, I agree with you there.
However, I believe that in order to maintain law and order in society, you need those who impose the law in order to abide by it themselves.
Yep.
And so, therefore, any kind of police corruption, police brutality, should be very swiftly dealt with.
Yeah, I mean, I still think overall we are quite lucky in this country to have what is overall a professional police department. I've seen many horror stories from the US where First, Second Amendment rights are frequently violated by the police. Alex Jones is very good at highlighting those. You see them all across YouTube. So we still are one of the lucky countries, I think, in regards to police professionalism. But yes, there are still, you know, unfortunate exceptions.
And sometimes they're quite nasty. Like Paul Heinrich, for example, he was hogtied, naked, and beaten on the hour every hour for an entire weekend in in the Henderson police station without food or water.
Wow.
You know, you hear stories like that, and you actually have the testimony from these people who this has just blatant dehumanization, you know, actual torture methodology being employed on people in this country. It's just sick. It's just terrible. And you don't know how to do it. And I interviewed this former police prosecuting sergeant named Grace Hayden. She's now a private investigator, was prosecuting sergeant for 15 years in New Zealand Police. And she told me, quote, "The New Zealand Police are so corrupt, you will either become corrupted or you will leave." Now, there's another element in this, and I think we're kind of getting a bit off topic in terms of the Auckland Unitary Plan and what have you, but I will say this. Intelligence is also, I think, an important part of being a policeman. If you can't think for yourself, it's certainly not a good idea to give you power and authority to over other people. And in the United States, and it's come out in Australia, and I've heard allegations that the same is true in New Zealand, that the police have testing methods when they're recruiting, both of which measure the applicant's intelligence and their morality. If you score too high on your moral obligations in society or your intelligence, you don't get in.
Wow. Sounds odd.
Well, not really, Because, let's say, for instance, would you agree that there's some laws in this country that require a police officer to lie not only to themselves, but to lie to the people that they're busting? Cannabis law enforcement, for instance.
I think perhaps maybe if they had a position on cannabis, which was that it shouldn't be illegal, perhaps they might not fulfil their legal obligations to prosecute it and look the other way or something. I mean, I've been involved once several years ago where I was caught with cannabis, and the officer just said, "Oh, we'll just throw it away. You got any more? Handed it all over. They threw it away." So,
yeah,
good use of discretion.
Exactly, and that was my point. Exactly,
yeah.
Is they can use discretion, but in a lot of cases they really don't.
Mm.
And you think about the harm that's caused by society. Let's say you join the police because you want to help society, you want to reduce harm in the community, and what have you. Does it reduce harm in community by arresting somebody, putting them in the cells for a night, giving them a criminal conviction, clogging up the court system for a drug that has never killed anybody in 10,000 years of recorded usage and doesn't cause violence with people that take it, unless it's taken with alcohol?
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely wrong.
See, so therefore, you'd actually need to be able to either believe the BS that you're being told and these laws that you should be enforcing, or you have to be a liar.
Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, my position on drugs is a very liberal one. I don't think prohibition works at any level.
Mm.
And, you know, I would like to see far more liberal laws. I think what Portugal's doing is fantastic. We're seeing drug-related harm and drug use plummet over
there. Yes.
And I think we could do the same here. Just continuing with cannabis, I'm very heartened to see the leadership changes that have happened in the ACT Party.
Mm.
Obviously, I left the ACT Party when John Banks got on board, because I couldn't be in a party run by a social conservative.
Yeah.
And now to see people like Jamie White, David Seymour. I mean, Jamie White's written extensively on drug legalisation. I know he's not going to make it ACT policy unless he gets a mandate from his members, so there's still a possibility there.
Mm.
But to have, you know, the leader of the Liberal Party, who we know definitely supports drug liberalisation, is a very positive thing.
Indeed, and we have seen a number of instances around the world just recently. Washington State and Colorado State have been full legalisation.
Yep.
And I think in the first day of Colorado legalising, they made $1 billion in taxation.
Mm.
In one day.
Yeah.
As opposed to spending $1 billion locking away non-violent drug offenders.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's a pretty straightforward positive sign, you know.
The disturbing thing is the federal government can step in at any time to end it if they choose.
Yeah, with the DEA. You're going to come to scare your PC birds. It's actually quite concerning to me on that. Because that's actually how I cut my teeth in political activism.
Mm.
Because I think when you have a personal experience, if you actually get arrested for cannabis at a young age, and I was, your entire world falls apart. Your entire life gets destroyed. You lose all your friends. You lose your family's trust. You get a criminal conviction. You think that your life is over. And I did. The law did far more harm to me than the drug ever did. And that inherent disparity really does need to be addressed. What's problematic is that you have people who are insane making the policy, okay? For example, United Future, Peter Dutton's United Future. I talked to one of his candidates that was standing for the Mount Albert by-election a number of years ago,
when
Helen Clark left the seat and was replaced by David Shearer. And this United Future woman, I asked her, so what's your policy toward cannabis, and don't you think you should make it legal because the prohibition isn't working? And she goes, well, actually, I think we should just try and stop it from getting into the hands of people in order to stop it causing harm. And I go, okay, and how many years have you been trying to enact that policy by keeping it illegal? Oh, about 20, 30, 40 years. And so now that 97% of New Zealand, the population from the ages of 18 to 25, 87% had tried cannabis, and over 50% in the 40-plus age range have tried cannabis, your policy isn't working. It's actually doing the exact opposite. And they can't see that. They can't see facts. Why is that?
And it's interesting, I mean, a slight criticism of Jamie White is that he says he wants to wait until the public's on board with drug law reform before he would look at advancing it as an ACT policy. Polls consistently show 75% of people support decriminalisation or legalisation, yet in Parliament we have a party that polls around 12% in the Greens, and the leader of a party which polls 0% in ACT are the only ones supporting it. National and Labour say, not going to happen with us, but there's clear public support for it.
Well, and it's because they're doing deals with Peter Dunne.
Yeah.
Every single fucking election!
Doesn't matter which election, Peter Dunne gets a deal.
Yeah, he gets a deal! And ironically, his deal is to keep the dealers in business by keeping it illegal!
And interestingly, he always wants the Minister of Revenue job. What a scummy minister to be! Who wants that job?
I want the revenue!
I want to be the tax man.
Yeah. I think it was Mark Twain that says, you know, the difference between a taxidermist and a tax man is? The taxidermist leaves the skin. And taxation in and of itself, if it's not apportioned taxation, it's immoral, in my opinion. And income taxes is something I did want to talk to you about as well. I mean, let's say in an ideal world, let's say you're Prime Minister and you've been given the dictatorial power that is given to a Prime Minister of New Zealand. You can elect all the cabinet members, you can ram through any parliament, any act or law you want under urgency. Nobody can do anything about it if you've got a majority. Would you pass any draconian laws to stop us being taxed unlawfully?
I have been an advocate of voluntary taxation for many, many years. I realise it doesn't have public support, so these days I advocate a low flat tax. I also advocate a high income tax free threshold of $15,000 a year. In an ideal world, yes, a voluntary taxation system which funds the courts, the police, the justice system, that would be my ideal. And you might go, well, who's going to donate to these things? Well, the role of the police, the justice and the military system in an ideal world is to protect the liberty of the individual. It's in everyone's interest to ensure there's a body protecting their liberties. Businesses can't function in a capitalist society if there's no way of enforcing contracts or protecting their property. But, you know, I've accepted that the public's not going to buy into that, so... I think we always will have an income tax, but I think it should be flat and it should be as low as possible.
And where does all the current income taxes go?
Social welfare, health, education are the big spending areas.
Now, do they publish stats of that every year, exactly how much tax has been given to the government specifically by income taxes? No other form of taxation. There's hundreds of forms of taxation. What does the income tax specifically go to? Is there ever any sheets or printouts to explain to people where that income tax goes?
Yep, comes out every budget. I don't have the figure off the top of my head, unfortunately.
Yeah, have you ever seen it once?
Yeah. Okay. It is on the internet. I will be able to find your website when I get home.
Okay. Because I was under the impression that income taxes simply go to pay the interest on the foreign debt, and all the other forms of taxes are usually apportioned and they go to running the country.
Okay, I don't think that's correct.
Okay.
But, I don't have all the exact figures on the top of my head right now.
All right. Well, my feeling on this is also banking reform needs to happen and happen sooner rather than later in this country. I'm concerned about the World Bank having or its role and its general policies being implemented in countries when people aren't even aware of those policy implementations. I think in the mid 90s there was a white paper that was leaked called 111 Points for Privatisation, a leaked document by the World Bank that chronicles an entire setup to how to take a publicly owned and democratically elected society to a completely privately owned corporate-run society using these World Bank methodologies. Privatise the water, privatise the police, privatise the army, and eventually privatise the government, so that every person who's elected is elected because a corporation financed them. Every time people pay for something, it's something that they've already paid for through their taxes and simply have to pay again to a massive corporation. nation. And I don't see a hell of a lot of difference between that happening in Argentina and what's happening here gradually, step by step. Now, it occurs to me that because we're borrowing money rather than creating our own equity with our own backed currency, that the banks can literally create money out of thin air to loan to people, and it disproportionately affects the way the economy works, and it disproportionately takes the power away from people being able to create, or the people, allegedly, being able to create their own money that is sound and backed versus international banks being able to create their own money out of nothing with zero backing, zero reserves.
Yep. Federal Reserve is a prime example of that. And when we look at the subprime crisis, which resulted in the recession about 5 years ago, there was no market correction. The Federal Reserve intervened. It bought up all the bad debt. It bailed out the banks. And then it started printing valueless money, which has seen the US dollar value drop. None of that should have happened. Because when you have a bubble, which was caused by the Federal Reserve policies anyway, encouraging people who can't afford loans into housing, you need a market correction. Otherwise, it just drags the recession out and makes the recovery much slower and much more painful. Have the quick correction. It was a bit harsh in the meantime, but then you recover very quickly. There was a recession in the United States in 1920 over in a year. No Federal Reserve interference. And then we look again at the depression following the stock market crash in 1929. That depression dragged out for a decade, right up until World War II, and that was at the time when Roosevelt was creating all these social programs, social welfare, public health, etc.
Incidentally, he also approved $1 trillion worth of loans during the depression to be given directly to Germany so it could build its war machine. You can't make this stuff up.
No.
You know, it's like, okay, my own people are suffering. There's no work. There's no money anywhere. Let's give $1 trillion to the Germans. That'll help.
Yeah.
And sure enough, it did.
Yeah.
Because without a massive German war machine to oppose, you wouldn't have revitalized the American industry by building tanks, bombs, and guns in order to go kill them.
Yeah.
You know, war is very profitable, especially if you're a banker who finances both frickin' sides.
Yeah. And I think that taxation was still around the 80% mark all the way through World War II as well. So any recovery was completely state funding driven. But those things are always temporary. You can only spend valueless money for so long.
Yeah. Well, unless, of course, you just make the money up. Now, I was talking with Suzanne Peisel from the US Independent yesterday. And she was laughing at people who were talking about the dollar collapse.
Mm.
And it was like, well, hold on a second. How can you say that the dollar collapse is laughable? And she goes, well, look at what all the bankers are doing. They're moving all of their money out of the paper assets and into digital currencies now. There isn't going to be a dollar collapse. It's simply going to be digitized and become a world global currency. There isn't really going to be a collapse of any kind of that nature, she's telling me.
And they're doing that because of the quantitative easing.
Mm.
Mm.
Now, do you feel quantitatively eased by that?
No, it freaks me out. I'm Weimar Republic, mass money printing. Zimbabwe, mass money printing. It doesn't work.
Yeah.
What is it? It's like $500 trillion to buy a loaf of bread in Zimbabwe now.
But I was talking with Vince Singer, who's a New Zealand court watchdog, right? And it was his opinion that New Zealand could actually learn a lot of good lessons about its policies and laws and everything from Robert Mugabe. Which is real funny, because a week or two before he told that to me, I was saying the same thing.
Don't tell too many people that.
Oh yeah. We've got some real policy changes in the works, you know.
Yeah.
And I was just like really taken aback at just how big the debt is growing. And it doesn't change. We elect Labour, they tripled health spending.
Mm.
And then after their third term of tripling the health spending, the amount of people killed by the health system then started to triple the road toll. It's just like, it doesn't make any freaking sense. Where's all this money going? I mean, are they just paying assassins to execute people with poison pills in the hospitals? Where's all this money coming from? And it's kind of like third world, right? I think my American producer, when I first started off doing this radio show, you know, Americans, I don't have a hell of a lot of knowledge about this world that they own and dominate, but he was saying that New Zealand's like a small town pretending to be a country. And I'm kind of like thinking about this as well. It's actually more like a third world country pretending to be a first world country, right? In a third world country, you go out, you can bribe cops, you can bribe politicians and things like that, and it's just kind of part of life, and everybody knows it's corrupt. New Zealand's different in that it's just as corrupt, and you can do just as much bribery and scumbaggery in this country and get covered up by the courts and what have you, except people have this perception that it's not corrupt.
Well, the politicians can still be bought by donations. There's no denying that. And again, it's not the donations to the politicians that's the problem. The problem is the power the politicians have to attract those donations and hand out favours.
See, and again, this is another discussion I was having with our mutual friend Will Ryan about the government having a monopoly of force. Now, no corporation would go after a politician to try and bribe him for doing something if the government couldn't offer them a monopoly of force and guaranteed contracts as a result.
That's right, yeah.
All right, you remove those barriers. Can we do that? I mean, if there was something to be legislated in New Zealand to prevent that kind of thing from happening, what would it look like?
I highly doubt we'll ever get to the point where the government's monopoly of force disappears. I don't think the voting... I mean, to do that, you'd have to go to a libertarian system. And I don't think the voting public is anywhere near advocating for that system. So all we really can do is try to take incremental steps to minimise the power of the state. But I think they'll always have that power of coercion. And I don't say that because I think it's a good thing, simply because that's how I think it'll work.
Yeah, I think you're correct on that that one. And we were talking about, you're talking about the public and what they are prepared for and what they're not prepared for. What occurs to me is social engineering is at play here. And as we discussed in the previous segment, the left, alleged left, is just as central as the alleged right.
Yep.
Which I think is actually part of the social engineering game, so that you capture people, much like the way that the Satanic Church and the Catholic Church works is somebody will go into the Catholic Church, they get disillusioned and they go, well, God can't be for me, that means Satan must be for me. And then they go into the Satanic Church and they go, well, Satan's not for me, I'm going to go back to being a hardcore Bible thumper. And I think that's what happens.
Yep.
You've got these two terrible organisations that just keep manipulating people, and they bounce back and forth and back and forth like a freaking pinball, never realising that both of them are full of crap.
Yeah, which is kind of like our two-party system, isn't it?
Well, it's like every two-party system. And I think it's like, as I mentioned, full-spectrum dominance. Visual light comes from ultraviolet all the way through to infrared. What are the two colours of the two main parties in every single freaking country?
Red and blue.
Red and blue, you know? They're literally working on a spectrum. And what I see happening now is, you know what the central colour is on the spectrum? Red's on one side, blue's on the other. What's central? Green! What's happening here? This is my theory, and I could be wrong.
All right.
Is that both the left and the right are actually left. They're actually all greenies, really, at heart, and they're all fighting for sustainability at the end of the day. And what we're doing here is they're using the spectrum to move people very, very slowly into this green, socialist, kind of totalitarian future sort of thing. Would you agree with that? Or at least see a general trend in that direction.
There's some merit in what you're saying there. I mean, the natural order for governments is to pass more and more and more and more laws. That's their entire job, passing laws. They've been doing it for decades. The right wants to control what we do with our bodies, the left wants to control what we do with our money, and both sides just keep on passing laws based on that. I don't really fit into the left or the right, because I want people to do what they want with their bodies as well as their money and property, so...
Yeah.
Well, but of course, I keep on getting called right wing, but it's not really the case.
Well, I don't know. Anybody who calls you a name and tries to pigeonhole you usually doesn't know where they stand on any particular issues and don't even understand what left or right actually means.
Yeah.
I mean, if you take, I believe when I was 15 in history class at Waiheke High School, I saw this poster that my history teacher had on the wall, and it had on the one side. Left wing extremism, which is total government domination of everybody's lives, no freedom, etc. And on the full hardcore right winger, it was total government domination of everybody's lives, no freedom or anything.
Yeah.
So you go to either extreme and they come into the exact same thing. That's how they've gotten away with it for so long, is because people think there's a difference.
Yeah, and there isn't.
There isn't.
The only difference is what they want to control.
Yeah. But the ultimate thing is they both want the same thing. Mm. Control.
Yes.
Just control for control's sake.
Mm.
And they gradually accumulate more and more of it until eventually you don't have any control over your own life because it'll all be decided for you.
Yep.
And I think Bill Cooper... great American talk radio show host, like the progenitor of Alex Jones, more or less, he said that socialism is like living with daddy, okay? It means daddy pays for the roof over your head, daddy pays for your food, daddy pays for the electricity, and, you know, keeps you safe and what have you, and provides you a car to use. But if you want to go to the next town, if you want to take daddy's car to go to a party or something like that, you have to have daddy say so.
Mm.
If he tells you to take out the garbage, you have to take out the garbage. So you're trading a gilded cage, right?
Yep.
That's all that it is saying, more or less, you're admitting to yourself that you don't have enough personal strength or integrity or intelligence to make your own decisions in your own life.
That's right.
And that's why you vote socialism.
Yep, couldn't agree more.
Why do people think like that? And I don't think they came up with it themselves. I think there's been a slow process of, pseudo mind control, more or less, through the culture over the latter half of the 20th century, I think, of that nature.
There's been very few examples of governments throughout history where which are not control-based. I mean, we could look at the US when it was initially founded, that constitution as a pretty good freedom-based document, but there's very few other examples that we can point to.
So, if these few examples wind up getting taken over by tyranny in the first place after they start off as libertarians, it brings into mind what Thomas Jefferson was saying, that the price of freedom really is eternal vigilance.
Yes, and people vote with their back pockets. They see the short-term incentive, oh, the government's going to give me welfare if I'm unemployed or something like that, and that just starts off more and more control.
Because then
you have to be taxed to fund that, and that's another right being taken away from you.
It's one thing leading to another, yeah?
Yep.
Okay. Now, unlike most people in the current political sphere, I've read into Agenda 21, I've studied the things about the New World Order, the Rockefellers, and the bankers, and what have you. So I know... based upon the documents and based upon admissions from high-level officials, that there is a ruling elite that runs the world, that controls banking systems and wants to produce a one-world government with a global tyranny. And when you have that mindset, as I do, it almost biases your ears to a degree. So if somebody says one thing and you instantly see the agenda at play there, kind of thing. And the thing is, where is the credible resistance to this kind of thing in the official spectrum? I mean, you and the Affordable Auckland and other affordable cities campaigns have indeed started to walk, I believe, in the right direction by addressing some of these core issues that are actually affecting New Zealanders that live in our urban areas, and that's really good. However, as a result of this, you know, in my opinion, overarching agenda, you wind up getting pigeonholed, phased out, demonised, derailed, and then become unsuccessful. And it's not because you can't do the job, it's because certain interests don't want you to. because they stand to lose power from them.
Yeah, I mean, I don't share your view about a small group controlling the world. I'm a bit sceptical about that. But I'm certainly not a supporter of things like a World Bank organisation. I'm not a fan of the United Nations, the IMF, all these sorts of things. I don't like international organisations which override a country's sovereignty, because those organisations can be used to strip individual rights in that country. And so, I'm fine with globalism. I think trading with other countries is exactly what we should be doing. That's what generates our wealth. But there shouldn't be this coercive control that we see through these international banking organisations, etc. Let's talk about the bailout of Greece. Obviously a complete basket case economy. The things that they needed to do to turn that around, the austerity, probably the right thing. Now, some parts are the right thing to do. The government spending definitely did need to come down. But, of course, when you reduce government spending and put up taxes, you kill your economy anyway. What probably should have happened there is just to let the market correction happen. Yes, it will be extremely tough on the populace in the short term when you have that correction. But if you don't allow the market to correct, you just drag out the misery. And yeah, I don't think there should have been a bailout by the European Union, and I don't support those sorts of financial arrangements that they have over there.
Well, I think I look at it as a very simple thing. Do you believe that positions of wealth and power attract the wrong people sometimes?
Absolutely. And the reason that happens is because governments have powers that they shouldn't have. The role of the government should be just to protect our individual liberty, run a court system, run the police. I don't have a major issue with having a public health system. I mean, I do believe in having a safety net for society's most vulnerable, but it's probably gone too far now. We're spending too much money, we're taxing too high. We really do need to limit the power of the government as much as possible.
What kind of safeguards do you think we could be able to put in place in order to protect the people from an overarching government? I mean, I think the United States, with its Second Amendment clause, which is if the government turns tyrannical, you can shoot them.
I'm a big supporter of the Second Amendment. I don't own a gun myself. I don't recall I've ever actually fired one. Yeah. But I do believe in gun rights. I do believe that people should be able to carry a weapon and have the means to defend themselves if necessary. And, I mean, obviously it is a means for defending yourself from a tyrannical government. I think the US Constitution, in its initial drafting, was actually an excellent document, and I would like to see something similar in New Zealand. Currently we have no real constitution, we have no limits on government power. We're just lucky that they've been relatively benevolent thus far.
Allegedly.
Relatively, yeah.
Well, I see, and again, it depends upon how far you look into it. I mean, I'm in the... I don't know if it's a fortunate or unfortunate position that I'm in to actually speak to people on a daily basis, more or less, that have had bad things that the New Zealand government has done to them. Not only that, but actually showing me a microcosm of actually how the true system works. And I've developed this philosophy that if it comes from an official source, whatever they say that they're doing, whatever they say that their intention is, it's probably the opposite. And if you can't cook it or make it yourself in your kitchen, then it's a soft kill bioweapon. Right? And that's essentially what has happened to me is you see the government, what's the stated intention of the government? They're there to protect you, right? Protect your rights.
That's my view, yes. Right?
So therefore they're there to take away your rights and enslave you. Which is exactly what's happening.
Yep. Well, there's always the law of unintended consequences when just about anything a government does. If we have a look at when they introduced the DPB, I think it was in the early 70s, you know, it was just there to look after the small number of single mothers who needed financial help. But it hasn't resulted in that. It's resulted in an explosion of single mothers who can't look after themselves.
I think that would probably be the result of feminism rather than the other one. I think there was a step, I forget what it was, I think it was something like 90% of female graduates from United States colleges in 1979 never had children.
Yeah.
And this this product of, again, social engineering has actually created massive consequences and layers upon layers on. It's what I call unintended consequences. So yeah. You have unintended consequences and a whole bunch of little offshoots and spectrum off of that.
Yep, and another example of unintended consequences, I used to work for Aerox many years ago. I sold party pills. And those were the BZP ones, and as far, and I still maintain that BZP is a relatively safe drug. Then that got banned, and it got replaced by this new whole lot of filthy crap. I mean, I've tried them, they make me feel sick, I don't touch the things now. And also years ago, when you had the BZP, you had these things called Spice, which were meant to be like a cannabis substitute. And those were pretty benign as well. I tried them, you know, didn't think much of them, didn't smoke them again, but you know, no health effects. And then these things get progressively banned, and the companies start bringing out more and more products which just get worse and worse and worse. And so the government thinks they're making us safer by banning these products, when actually we're just getting exposed to more horrible crap as a result of their intervention.
Exactly. I think this is also the main problem with cannabis prohibition as well, is that you have a look at all the side effects and what have you. Look, nobody has died in 10,000 years of recorded usage of cannabis, apart from the people getting shot in the back running away from the police. And then, of course, if you make it illegal, but if there's a market demand for something, people will try and fulfill that demand so that they can make money off of what the public wants. Why has the government not cottoned on to this?
Capitalism works, mate. No matter how many laws you pass, capitalism will continue to work.
It'll continue to work. Unless, of course, you subvert it and wrap it in a flag of some description and tell everybody that socialism is capitalism. You know, and I'm also concerned about the international trade agreements that we've got, like the TPPA and what have you. Totally secret, has massive abilities for international corporations to come in, and you can't be held accountable to a law that a country makes if you're an international company under this agreement, more or less, right? So if a tobacco company comes in and they say, well, New Zealand's laws require taxation on our products, that goes against our competitive model, we're going to sue you in the world court, which us corporations own and always get the judgment we want. And so your country will be fined for making legal things happen that threaten a corporation's economic viability.
Yep.
In principle, that doesn't actually sound like too bad an idea. Like, it's actually a really bad idea for a government to just restrict and destroy business left, right, and centre, open slather. But if you put it back on the other spectrum, a corporation dominates the government, doesn't it? There's a delicate balance that needs to be struck here, and I don't think those delicate balances can be struck with absolute secrecy. That needs to be leaked by WikiLeaks in order for people to know what the hell's going on.
Yeah, well, I would like to discuss the TPPA a wee bit. Obviously, the issue is that it is still secret, so the opponents of it are telling me, oh, it's going to do all these bad things. They don't actually know, because it's secret.
Yeah.
My usual instinct is to support free trade agreements, but once again, I don't know what's in the TPPA, so I can't say I support it or don't support it. If it gets rid of... if it eliminates tariffs... if it eliminates government control on businesses, and I mean that in the sense that businesses are free to trade with their customers, I don't mean in the sense that corporations start controlling governments. But
statistically, that's what always happens.
Yes. So if it results in less regulations over the market and freer trade, great, support it. I think that's a fantastic thing. But I don't know if the TPPA is actually going to do that, and I'd like to know what's in it.
Well, every free trade deal that I've actually looked over and seen the results of, all it is a precursor for even greater government power.
Well, it's not free trade, it's managed trade.
Well, exactly. What they do is, again, if it's an official source, it's the opposite. So if they say it's a free trade agreement, that's a slave trade agreement, all right?
Yep.
So let's take the European Economic Community, for example. They say, oh, we're going to have free trade, it's going to be a great little trading organisation, and then all of a sudden you've got a European Parliament that is passing draconian laws across everybody else's country's governments and all of that kind of stuff, and completely subverting everybody's freedoms, and that all started with it's going to be good for trade.
Have you seen how thick the regulations on bananas in the EU are?
Sweet mother
about that. About that thick.
and again, this proves my point, doesn't it?
Yes.
If you're trying to create economic prosperity through legislation, it does the direct opposite. It only winds up making it worse.
And I mean, free trade agreement with China. You know, I was first to say, great, free trade with China. Support that, but even years later, we don't actually have free trade with China. There are still tariffs on our wood imports into China.
Mm.
That's not free trade, it's a trade agreement.
Yeah.
And I suspect that the TPPA will end up being the same thing. It'll be a trade agreement, but it won't actually be free.
And again, anybody tells you I'm going to do this, it'll be free or what have you, there ain't nothing free in this world.
But I'm still going to reserve my judgment until I've seen everything in it, but I am suspicious.
WikiLeaks has leaked the documents, so they're there. They're there for public scrutiny. And what happened in the House, I think it was Winston Peters, David Cunliffe and Russell Norman, the Greens, Labour and New Zealand First, basically the opposition leaders, all attempted in the House of Parliament upon the discussion of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, attempted to table this document that was leaked from WikiLeaks.
Mm.
And the government's response was, we don't look at anything from WikiLeaks. Because it reveals damaging things, right? And these are real documents, they've been confirmed, they've been verified, and it's very, very damaging to the government.
Mm.
And so the government, instead of taking responsibility and saying, yeah, I guess it's not that good, maybe we should amend it a little bit, they go, it doesn't exist, even though it's right there in their hands, and we're not going to allow you to table it.
Yeah.
That strikes me as a very, very childish approach to public policy setting.
Mm.
And indeed, one of my guests a while back, I forget exactly who it was, but they had a 6-year-old child that they took into Parliament just to watch Parliament in session. And the child was seeing these politicians arguing back and forth. And the child looks up at his dad and he goes, man, Dad, they're like a bunch of kids.
They really are.
That's, I think, one of the natural consequences of bad parenting, right?
Yeah.
In other words, no discipline. Now, did you know that there's no code of conduct for parliamentarians? No enforceable code of conduct?
There is a code, I believe, but it's not enforceable. You're right.
What kind of a country has no actual rules?
Mm. Well, we don't even have an actual constitution.
Yeah.
Mm.
We don't have a constitution. We don't have any actual rules in Parliament. The Prime Minister comes in, gets elected, regardless of which party, and he gets to handpick his completely unelected cabinet. Incidentally, when the Super City came in, when you get elected mayor, you get to handpick your completely unelected cabinet as well.
Yeah, it's a little bit different. They're more advisors. They don't have any actual power. But what does concern me about the Super City is the Independent Māori Statutory Board.
Really? I don't know
how you
heard about that.
Okay. They're built into the Super City legislation, and they are elected by a mana whenua committee, basically. I think there's maybe it doesn't...
Is that money of the land?
Yes, it's a committee of mana whenua who were elect from... You know, a dozen of them. The two people who are going to be on the people who are going to be on the Independent Māori Statutory Board. Sorry, so there's two people who get to vote on council legislation. The board itself is actually bigger, but there'll always be two of them who can vote, you know, on a committee or on a council vote and things like that. And they're not elected by the people, so I mean that's incredibly disturbing. John Tamahiri's on the statutory board.
Oh, of course he is.
Yeah, I'm not sure who else is.
Yeah.
I get really disturbed by the amount of advisory boards we have as well. I mean, we've got a Pacific Affairs Advisory Board. Len Brown yesterday at the Big Gay Out was saying he wants an advisory board for gays, lesbians and transgender. And you might think, oh, well, I'm gay, I'll go hooray. But no, I won't, because I think it's actually incredibly offensive that they would have this idea that all gay, lesbian and transgender people think the same. So men who have sex with men, women who have sex with women, people who aren't sure what sex they are, people who have sex with everyone, and people who have changed their sex, according to Len Brown's logic, all think the same.
Pirelli's, you know, we need some sensitivity training, you know.
Yeah.
And this is another thing that I find very interesting about the gay and lesbian community, is they're so fractured, it's just not funny.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
There is no unitary thing. As far as I'm concerned, there's only one person in one social group, the individual.
Yes.
If you start bargaining for people on a collective basis, you wind up destroying everybody's rights.
Yeah, you can't have a gay opinion.
Yeah.
You can have the activist at the top saying, give us more money. That's usually their opinion. But there is no gay opinion. There's no Maori opinion. There's no Asian opinion.
Yeah, exactly. Everybody's... we're all snowflakes.
We're all snowflakes, darling.
And it was just like, what the frack is going on here? PC God Matt, that's what it is.
Yeah.
We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, after the break at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Bear in mind, this is a listener-supported broadcast, so if you like these kind of discussions happening, where we're actually doing the job the media really should be doing, having intense conversations, long form, with activists and people who are great political thinkers of our times, go to the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Corporate media needs corporate funding. Real media needs funding from real people. I would love if everybody who listened to the show would donate a couple of dollars a month. You can donate between $1 and $100 a month. I don't give a crap which. As long as you give something to the real emergent media in this country and the voices that I ensure get recorded and published for public scrutiny. I'm simply trying to facilitate the debate. We'll be right back.